popping him off for tonight's blow-by-blow with Andreas may be disappointed. Hank and I actually agree on virtually everything, but I have a few ringers for you. About a year ago, Hank pulled me aside and said, you know what, in Philadelphia, I want to talk and I want you to respond. I said, what are we going to talk about? Don't worry. So on Friday morning at 5:30 a.m., he sent over the text, and just now I saw the slide. So it's a very good presentation. Thank you. I will say I had actually interpreted it differently, which was, and my presentation is really, what do you intend to do beyond Lead MD? So I've got a plan to take over the world. But let me first respond with a few of Hank's points. First of all, you know you've been successful when you're being attacked. And so I take pleasure, and I think Susan and Victor and other people who are literally tithing their work week to do the Lead MD work, take great gratification in that. So,
was that an attack?
Well, it was no, but no. I mean, that's what I say.
Oh, you're trying to be provocative. Okay.
I'm trying to be offended. I'm happy. But, a couple things. I mean, I will say there were a couple of points where I thought, Hank, where have you been? The two were when you were dissing on Lead MD for not addressing affordability, accessibility, and housing diversity. We explicitly address all three of those things. So anyway, take a look.
I know that. Actually.
I know that. See, this is the thing. He attacked it. I attack him back. We agree. Okay. The second one is in terms of the CNU. I will only say that I'm in year six or seven of showing a pair of slides, which I'm not going to show today, which is the comparing the green building and the green field location, which we all hate, then I usually show a picture of Seaside. And, what could be wrong with Seaside? Well, Seaside, for those of you who don't know, the coating required authentic materials, which were in existence before 1940. So it's a seashore environment, salt spray, so they basically did wood siding. And the local contractors assure me that every house in Seaside needs to be repainted between every 5 and 7 years at a cost of $30,000 to $40,000, right? And that may have the numbers a little bit wrong. That is not sustainable, but that is our cherished pilgrimage site in our movement. So there's a disconnect there. Second one at Seaside is the air conditioning, which is, if you go to Seaside and you think, oh boy, I can't wait to be on the ocean, this is gonna be really fun. The windows are shut all year round in Seaside, and for that portion of the year where the air conditioning is running, it's an awful place to be. It is awful. The air conditioners are loud, they're hot, they assure that if you wanted to open the windows, you will quickly shut them back down because it's really unpleasant. So it's really a neutron bomb town for big parts of the year where buildings are present but humans are missing. And so there are issues even with successful new urbanism. I will say that the CNU, I think, has gone from, and maybe I'll just, is Andreas here? Darn.
He's got a session right now, I think.
I will say Andreas is some measure as a kind of bellwether or a canary for the movement. On this issue has gone from, it's not my problem. We love urbanism circa 1930, and that was pretty good. And then the kind of second argument you get from him is, it stood the test of time, lots of people have chosen it over the generation, so it must be pretty good. Who am I to know better, right? So that's one. More recently, he has shifted a little bit, and some of your slides I'd be interested to hear his reaction to. But he said, Doug, there's a big transect violation when you deal with stormwater above, T3 or so. It is a transect violation. It is an aesthetic problem. You can't have the scruffies next to the knee, right?
I wasn't attacking you there. I was attacking him there.
I know.
Yeah.
But more recently, Andreas, yesterday, I said, Andreas, scruffy versus knee. He said, Doug, I never said that was an aesthetic problem. It's a cultural problem. As you can see, the denial, recognition, first argument falls away, second argument falls away, and so, and hold this up. In fact, this is the work of DPZ, Life Imprint New Urbanism. What does it do? Stormwater, right? So the movement is shifting, and I think it's a great thing for us all. Let Let's see. The other thing I was going to say, just in terms of the CNU, you know, we've been trying for years, some of us, to get this dialogue jump started. So we had Bill Benster in Chicago, five years ago.
Yeah.
And I believe in going to the center of the opposition and drag them here and put them on a panel and debate it. And so we did it with Dunster, who did do that project, and it's terrible urbanism, but it is an inspiring, interesting, you know, building.
I brought him on a charrette, too.
Right.
Yeah.
See, we don't...
He couldn't sit at the table with us.
Right. Well, he came to Chicago and wondered, why did we invite him? He was tapped by the traditionalists in England, which Hank now is. kind of like a Swedish guy this morning. So anyway, that's interesting. But Dunster, Herbert Dreisaitl, these are people that have figured it out. And so if people haven't been going to those sessions, please start going to those sessions, because we feel like we've been running enough of flagpole. Couple things. This will sort of launch into my what I want to present you. Couple things is, you know, Hank's presentation is really focused on design, as it should be. But I will say that we in the CNU have, I think, been overwhelmingly focused on the design of our own projects. And we've left the smart growth movement to be our spokespeople. And that was a huge mistake. And those of you who have ever heard John Norquist say, you know, what is the definition of smart growth? Well, you know what I mean. And that's what it's been for years. And so there's been new urbanism, and there's been a sort of dearth of nothing out there. And I will say that the new urbanists, when we went in partnership with these other organizations and sought to define what our work was, what their work was we were pretty good at it. We're pretty good at policy, and I hope we've done a good job and we'll continue to improve it. But I will also say that CNU, having 1% of the market, that is an utter failure. It is just inexcusable that we're at 1% of the market. It's not good. That is also not good enough.
Mm.
Anybody disagree?
No.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't we be 10%?
What's your definition?
I defer to others, but that's Rob Studebaker.
Greenfield development?
No, I don't.
What about the urban development? That should count too.
That's fine. Not my statistic. Thank you, Shelley. whatever it is, it's not good enough. We should have a lot.
You did answer.
Thank you. Thanks.
We knew they were going to be trouble, didn't we? Yeah.
Split those guys. I don't get in there. Come on. But anyway, it's a failure. We can and should do more. And so what I think is true about LEED-ND is it is an effective tool for clearing the ground to receive our stuff and to clear away, I think, policy and to also enlist tens of thousands of other people who are clueless about our stuff who, with a reprogramming, less painful than reprogramming engineers, by the way, I think will come over to be urbanists. And I look back on the great tradition in this, when I was coming up in the 70s, I think we must have gone to all the same conferences, to go to hear Doug Kelbaugh, Peter Calthorpe, and Ed Mezger. These were the 70s. Solar guy Tim was there too.
Plenty,
right?
Yeah.
Two out of four have actually gone, long ago went to be city planners and said, you know, what, screw the individual building, this is making no progress. Two did not, and one of them's come to speak to us tomorrow, which is Ed Mezri, and he's still obsessed about the building. But I believe that reprogramming is possible, and the 36,000 new accredited professionals will come our way. This is just a reminder.
We better be ready.
So, Hank, as I can't disagree with you.
It's an Australian image. Yeah. It's an Australian image, yeah.
Where is it?
Australia.
No,
I've seen it in Australia.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah. Just as a reminder, because we haven't, you know, Hank showed only nice pictures. This is our country, right? And so it's really on the wrong course.
The American thing.
It is. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, this is fantastic. You all, you know, British colony types.
Well, at the least, it would have been an American export.
Right. Could be. I show this only to say, I did want to say a couple things about this book and about what I hope to do, you know, with LEED-ND and after LEED-ND. I've written a book, You'll All Be Suffering Through Seeing It, you know, in upcoming conferences and so on. It comes out in October. The title is Sustainable Urbanism, Urban Design with Nature. The publisher is Wiley. And in it, it's closely related, obviously, to the work we've done, all of us in Lead ID. But I define sustainable urbanism this way, as a three-legged stool. Traditional urbanism integrated with high-performance buildings and implies high-performance infrastructure. So three components. And so, and rather than those three components simply being adjacent, the word integrated is, you know, should have italics, which is they somehow work together in the way that urbanism works together. So this is the definition. We found that there's actually a vibrant practice in this internationally. Some of Hank's projects are in this dumpster. You know, good and bad dumpster is in, even the Don Tang that you mentioned. I feel like we're kids at this. We really yep. don't know what the hell we're doing. And to say that Poundbury trumps, you know, BedZed in terms of overall metrics and performance, you know, I shrug and say I really don't know. I think we all aspire to the same thing, which is high quality of life and high environmental performance. Mm-hmm. And we're really at the baby steps, but the beginning of a movement. And I believe and hope that Lead ND helps define that. But the thesis of the book is that this thing that we've defined as sustainable urbanism needs to become the dominant pattern of development in the U.S. in a generation. And by generation, I'm saying 2030, which is why I do like Ed Mesrea's campaign, because it sets a limit on it. And this is the kind of implication, ending sprawl by 2030, right? So there's now an industry of smart growth, there's an industry of new urbanism, but nobody set an end date. And so I believe that when you do these sorts of things, you motivate people and you get smarter and you get strategic, and this is actually completely doable if we are organized and smart about it. So what does that say? Implementation strategy. This is, you know, the book. Maybe you don't ever need to buy the book or read the book, you can just read it. But establishing weights and measures. This was an experience many of us had when LEED came out, is suddenly we didn't have to argue about what the hell a green building was. It was defined for us. And in establishing those common metrics or standards or something, suddenly lots of things can happen. So a developer that, a town that wants a green development can just simply specify a LEED ND level. We would like a gold here, or we'd like a silver, so on. So it's a commodity. So there's the industry will figure out in the next few years sort of how to provide a silver and a gold and a platinum and so on. So, and with that, markets are made. And I would say that we have, as a movement, chosen to retain an artistry about what we do and to keep it a bit mystical, and that there are oracles who speak, and you go home and you try and keep the spirit of the oracle alive for a couple of months, and then you come back 12 months later and get recharged with the spirit of the oracle and so on. And that has been a very nice medieval approach to getting the word out. But the modern era requires, you know, actual standards. And so Lead ND, imperfect as it is, we hope, has gone away to get that. Second step is, you know, dismantle the petroleum era regulations, and I would argue that virtually everything that stands in the way of implementing new urbanism is suspect, because it was adopted, you know, during the time and after the time we became auto-dependent. So most of it all goes away. And then the third one, which is the kind of embodied in the 2030 community challenge, as we've called it, is make the campaign for sustainable urbanism this generation's moonshot. That the times are ripe, I believe it nationally and certainly within our movement, for this to just take off and this become the norm. It's really, I feel like it's on people's lips. We all know the environmental benefits of location, and so I'm endorsing what Hank said and Scott and others contributed to, no question there. Here's the 2030 Architecture Challenge. For those of you who haven't seen it, you'll see it again tomorrow morning, so, you know, avert your eyes if you're planning to come then. But here it is by Ed Mesrea. It basically says every building ought to ascribe to these targets by 2005, a 50% reduction over average energy consumption, and so on. And then the culmination is in 2030, all buildings, and the way Hugh says it is, on their own, should be carbon neutral. And so Hank's kind of wacky diagram of every house with its own windmill, every house with its own systems and so on is exactly what you could interpret him literally to be asking you to do. What I like about this, though, is that this campaign format is effective. It has been adopted by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the AIA, lots of other organizations, and they are now going one at a time. Chicago, I got called to the meeting next week to figure out what the hell this means that the city's supposed to do differently. Apparently, you know, the message is basically, apparently the mayor voted on this a year or so ago, and now we're charged with implementing this. What does that mean, right? So we should have one that focuses on our stuff too, right? So that cities are challenged to do that. Here's kind of a preview of it, and this just jumps the gun. And Scott, you are responsible for orally communicating two data points, and so if I got them really screwed up, you know, my apologies. But I thought you said something about this. This is DMT over the 20th century, basically. We started out not having cars, not driving them very much, so that's kind of an easy bet. But I remember you saying something around 1930, we were making 750 or 1,000 DMT, something like that. Jumping up to 1969, that number was 3950. 3950 miles DMT, and so in the 2000s, 8100 vehicle miles per capita. So that's where we are. So it's quite a steep incline, and so you know, business as usual takes us up like that. I will say that as you know, driving increased, urbanism was devalued. We've all heard this over the years, and it's absolutely true. And so I wonder if you were to decrease the rate of driving, if urbanism wouldn't just snap back into place, just culturally. So Andres says it's a cultural problem. If it is a cultural problem, if you stop driving so fast and so much, urbanism will be, I think, demanded. So anyway, this is one possible outcome to a challenge we might come up with, which is that by 2030 we drive as much as we did in 1969. So visualize the Mustang convertible and the fun we all had in 1969. Petula Clark on the radio, the whole thing. And so I don't know if this is the right thing. I don't know if this is achievable, but it's a challenge that is, I will say, silent. The word Ed Mesrea, Al Gore, nobody's talking about this, and it's probably because it's scary and unpopular, but it is certainly envisions a life lived locally, right? Which I think will, that's all screwed up. I don't know what that is. We'll go over that. So LEED ND. So this is sort of where we are. LEED ND pilots happened, 371 applications, 40% of which were by CNU members. So we are a significant share of this. This is something that we have embraced, I would say, overall. And I challenge everybody in the room, how many people were LEED ND pilot applicants? A few people? Okay. Those of you who are, come back with a new project next year, your second project, or third project, or in Tim's case, his fifth project. And if you don't have one, get one. So by next year, everybody in this room comes back with one. That'll be another 100 projects. Okay, so let's do that. There are 42 states in the District of Columbia, 8 foreign countries, not bad. And then the next stat, I wasn't able to check, but maybe it's 500 square miles or so seeking LEED ND certification. The state of Rhode Island is 1,044 square miles. So it's quite a lot of land. So these are bigger bites, right? So this is nice. It's also effective, I'll say this, in terms of our partnership with the USGBC, it is very effective that one of the projects of Dockside Green, in a single bite, proposed 26 LEED and the LEED Platinum buildings, with agreeing to forfeit $1 million bond if all of their buildings weren't LEED ND Platinum. And this one LEED Platinum, in this one LEED ND project, we doubled the world supply of LEED Platinum buildings. So, you know, are we helping the USGBC? Yes, we are. So it's a sweet tool. It's got a lot of sort of stickiness to it. Oops, I'm sorry. The transition to Hank's computer, we lost a couple of things. So Susan Mudd has suffered with this more than anyone else. Thank you, Susan, for not just coughing and guffawing. But this is part of, you know, my plan to take over the world, which is, you know, on the foundation of LEED Green Building, sort of one building at a time, you know, ho-hum, we're getting there very slow. LEED, after 8 years, 9 years, has less than 1,000 buildings worldwide. And they realize they have a scale problem. Sustainable land developments is the next scale, which is, you know, ND. I heartily endorse the idea that there be leadership standards for plans, comp plans, levels of governance, and so on, and then we will achieve true enlightenment. So, anyway, there's LEED Green buildings, there's a bunch of types of them. Here's the sort of middle land, sustainable land development. ND, we've talked about an existing neighborhood for sort of dialing up existing, if you will, old urbanism, districts, landscapes, and infrastructure systems. There's a graphic where every part of the world could get a lead rating and so on. Even that clover leaf, which John beats me up on every time, I don't change the graphic. But what are the infrastructure systems that should get a leadership standard and so on? And then plans and governance, you know, regional plans, municipal plans, state plans, and so on. And I think that's a lot of potential. So here's the schedule, and I just, as a teaser to people, you know, how could we get to 2030? So NB adopted, 2009-ish. I am an advocate for doing a code version of LEAD-ND. Municipalities are already using it and adopting it as a requirement for either in negotiation with individual developers as a way of filtering the bad juju out of their zoning codes and other ordinances, and so on. So it's out there. It's being used by Kane County as a criteria for deciding developer impact fees. The state of Illinois passed legislation to provide a floating enterprise zone designation for ND projects. I mean, it's governments are using it, and we really need to take the lead to create a friendly version of it. Municipal adoptions, state adoptions. When will Wall Street, that writes municipal bonds, decide that this is a good lending criteria? If your town, has adopted ND as its requirements, that's a lower cost of business. You're at better risk. Your bond ratings improve if you adopt ND, and so on. So there's a whole, 20 things that might happen over the years to come. My intention, beyond that lead ND is to embed it. So I think I'll stop there.
So. So I think, Doug, that while we agree that LEAD-ND is a step forward, I think we do end up with a different kind of set of paths going forward. And I'll grossly mischaracterize both of us, if I might. All right. Your path forward is set the rules and cover the world with the rules, and the market will respond by developing approaches that will lead to sustainable urbanism. And our energy should go into influencing rules that will cover and I would say that we should set the rules, but at this point we need to devote some of the energy that we've been devoting to setting rules or standards to developing collaborative and collective best practice in design terms. I guess what you're saying is actually individual design practices will do that in response to a set of standards, so there's not a role for the CNU in sharing. It's not essential for the CNU to take that step.
No, I think that'd be a lovely step. I think it makes sense as an organization that we provide the forum to do that. We agree.
Okay. Well, damn. John Torti and I and Stephanos Polyzoidis and Liz Moule have been talking with John Massengale about a charter council on this whole question of sharing design techniques, particularly around stormwater and yep. renewables. So that seems like it's a complementary action to this path.
Well, let me try and pick a fight with you, which I think I got a rise out of you, last time we talked about this, which is I had said that the Ed Mesrias 2030 Architecture Challenge poses some, those of us who are trying to design buildings that actually do meet all their energy externally, you find that the traditional form drops off as a human tool that can actually achieve the higher levels of performance, that the building as an artifact of culture as well as an instrument in sort of all the aims that we aim to meet as individuals and as a society, I would argue, needs to morph to time.
What is the traditional form?
Well,
is that a masonry building? Is that timber frame building? Is that what you're talking about as a traditional form? Or?
Well, there's in your... Could you put some of your pictures up? Because they would be instructive. There are a bunch of circumstances, building orientation, those of us, who do...
So that's urbanism.
That is urbanism, so it's a thing that is handled in code. It's not the architectural code yet. Ridge lines can also be a fairly big factor, whether or not the The building is suited to receive either active solar hot water or solar photovoltaic, and so the coating can determine that and other things. But I'm just saying.
So those achieve the Eco Home Excellent rating.
But all I'm saying is that as a movement, we have embraced traditional urbanism, which tended to be coal or wood heated. It's when it was sort of matured as a type. You know, the furnace technology improved and was swapped out. Over the years, air conditioning got added.
You know, when they developed windows,
yeah.
People figured out how to put them in walls. And they were still traditional buildings, but they were traditional buildings with glazing. Yeah, and when they developed steel, they were able to build railroad sheds that span greater distances.
Yeah.
But they were evolutions of tradition.
Yeah.
And what I said was that tradition needs to evolve to embrace the challenges of global climate change and a lesser reliance on petroleum.
Well, maybe if I can put a wedge.
But so I'm trying to say, is it because that has a pitched roof? Is that a problem? Does it need to be a swoopy roof?
No. But I'm not here to defend swoopy roofs.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what you mean by traditional form, and
right.
Yeah.
If you start at the enterprise of saying, let me build an Ed Mesria building, building on a given site that will meet a really high performance building criteria. And we've got a couple in our office that are, generate more power than they consume, for example. The form, given current technology and sort of everything we know, and maybe we don't know enough, doesn't result in that form.
My team went to Austria to look at the passive house, which actually requires no external heat source to keep it warm. And while that's one issue, I think in most cities it's actually getting the hot air out that's more of a problem. But we didn't find anything in that couldn't be done in a terraced house or a row house. And it appears to us that it's largely about improving the quality of construction and the quality of the way that the roof and the wall sections meet one another, so you're not having a lot of heat loss. And they do it through a membrane system. And we want to look at a membrane to see if actually that is a robust and long-lived material, because if we're building these houses and we want them to live for 200 years and you've got a thin plastic membrane, which is what they're doing with the passive houses, you're maybe embedding failure into the system.
I think we all appreciate that. I guess these houses face out, one's on the left, is that right?
Just yeah.
By the panel. That depending on climate, I really don't know a lot about your climate or this climate, enhanced glazing on the south can be a benefit. Mm-hmm. And so that may be a stretch of a traditional form, but not a violation of it. Window treatments are a big plus in architecture and shading when you want to shade and not when you don't. They're part of traditional architecture. They're not there, but could be added.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, maybe we're not disagreeing again.
Don't we have to convince the builder to build these houses? What if the mass builder has no incentive whatsoever to build these houses? Isn't it really a bit of a moot point?
That's where the code comes in.
Yeah, the code is intended to shift the market.
So I'm not going to build it to inform it.
Yeah.
Require it.
Yep. It's a good. Scott had his hand up for a while.
First of all, I have the pleasure of responding to Ed Mesria tomorrow. We'll try and make it almost as entertaining as this entertaining. But it's a couple of additional points. I mean, it seems to me that the point that Hink opened with, Doug, needs a little bit more thought than hoping for the oracle, namely that we've got to measure and verify these results if it's actually going to count in the fight towards climate change. And that's equally true on the chart you put up on what would come up for the 2030 challenge. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to get the resources or the political oath behind the urbanism simply by claiming it. And so somehow it seems that, and perhaps we could make this a theme of a future Congress, is to figure out how to get by with both enough accounting for an audit in these projects without drowning the project in a sea of accountants and auditors. They actually get there and still build demand. And secondly, you may be familiar with the studies commissioned a couple years ago by the Ford Foundation that says, you know, building better communities of practice is one of five key strategies for rapid change, and that's what I would call the strategy that you've outlined here. The others were change policies, change politics, change marketplace practice, and build rapid social learning, i.e. build demand, build community, and so forth. And somehow putting this in context, it seems to me, would make a much stronger sort of case. In other words, you've got a great set of tools here in new urbanism. The question to ask is how to build your awareness and appreciation of the value and the rapid demand, which would be my third point, which is that a good idea left on a shelf isn't like a good bottle of fine wine. It doesn't get better the longer it sits there. And so I think at the heart of the Stern report is the observation that we need rapid learning in order to actually get there. My question for both of you is, what should we imagine besides either better rules, such as you called for, or Hank called for a better appreciation of the practice that might actually build that more rapid change. And climate change is the ultimate potential aligning force, but if you get it wrong, actually, we've got a real problem on our hands. And so how do we do that?
Good.
You both thought about it.
Okay, well, what I want to do is get a few things out, and then we can sort of maybe have a discussion about that question. So it's what else is there besides evolved practice and evolved rules?
Yeah. Well, actually, this kind of segues pretty neatly into
good.
That. If, obviously the governmental forces and design standard forces are kind of slow, relatively speaking, take a long time to implement them, whereas things like economic forces are pretty strong drivers. And similar to the work that we've done, since we're talking about beyond lead and D, if you could, as with the statistics and statistical process control methodologies that were propounded by Deming that were converted by a guy named Taguchi into dollar figures. And as soon as that was done, it was embraced whole hog by industry and started sweeping. If we could do this, because certainly in sort of like the time-dollar continuum, you can convert time into money, and we know that the higher performance stuff that you're proposing actually converts into dollars.
Yeah.
And if we can make that language into dollars in the next phase, then we can also get people who can invest in the longer term to also get the money for the investment.
Well, that's happening up here with the question of climate change, and Stern, Stern monkeyed a little bit with discount rates and found these huge benefits. And we haven't even begun to talk about carbon trading systems and how they might apply in urbanism or building sector. But there's that's a fruitful area to begin to talk about, to bring that in, and that begins to deal with the question of how do you get the builders to do it. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I did as well. I guess when you were talking about the differences between the standards versus the best practices, one of my kind of thoughts and also questions was, how do you have a national standard to issues that are very, very local? And especially, in the case of stormwater, obviously that's different from one side of the state to another. And how do you deal with that and try and, not make sure that the wrong government is adopting the wrong standard because it's the best one out there and the only one they can model?
Yeah, you've grappled with that.
We've run that risk. We've adopted our stormwater standard is now regionally specific, or actually climate zone specific, into arid, semi-arid, and wet. So teach us what the problems are during the pilot program. We'll try and fix them. But we have taken on the task of a national one-size-fits-all standard. So we're going to hit some glitches along the way. I'm sure.
Against the wall, and then Dan Solomon.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it really is the mosaic. And I think history teaches us that with the evolution of building codes, until the Great Fire with the shirtwaist factory happened, people died. A lot of things that people on the fringe have been advocating in terms of fire safety and buildings didn't happen, and it had a sweeping national effect. We've actually seen 100 years incrementally that have changed in the building code that is now implemented. If you recall back in the time when fire happened, then the developer today said this will be the end of Western civilization as we know it, because you will put people in the streets and be anarchists. market and streets, all sorts of great things, and of course none of it happened, civilization flourished. So I think there's a tipping point. As all this body comes together, there will be a point, whether it's on this timeline or not, but there will be a point when something happens that triggers a mass consciousness that causes these things to be adopted. The other part of it is, too, though, about the market side, for those of you that are aware of it, the great evil need nasty Walmart, probably as a corporation with the amount of power they have, they're implementing some as a building type, some of the most incredible building conservation standards you can imagine. And because of their size, they're causing a trickle throughout the industry, from HVAC to lighting to anything you want. They share the technology freely. From a crazy place comes great things.
Well, they got to work on their logistics and transport systems,
yes,
too. Yeah.
Dan? I hope this is not question, not sector, but it strikes me that this so-called supposed conflict between the traditional urbanist echo house that you have on the screen and bedset is a complete red herring, because the house you have on the screen is almost the same thing as bedset.
Oh.
Well, let me finish.
I agree.
Because it's a silent valley. It's a row of houses facing south, which is anti-urban. It was anti-urban in the 20s when it was proposed as a silent valley, which was all about civil orientation. It's anti-urban in China, where it's absolutely the new residential fabric, the south-facing row houses. That your Boundary houses in Bedset have to, you sneer at Bedset as being lousy urbanism, but it's exactly the same. Because you haven't dealt with solar orientation in the north-south block. So it's really a matter of how do you solve the problem of a north-south area orientation in a perimeter block to make urbanism out of solar orientation. And your houses have exactly the same problem as Bedset.
And actually the photovoltaics really are not a major contributor to the performance of that house. But I think that's right. And it's a more complicated. It's the question of the perimeter block, and it's a question of optimizing. I mean, Bill Dunster and I have had this discussion. His problems actually are more profound than those of Poundbury because he doesn't have a perimeter block. He parks all the cars on the outside. I mean, he's got a different...
For exactly the same reasons that historically solar orientation has not made perimeter blocks. It seems like that's a typological issue, is the unique contribution that CNU can make to the...
I didn't have time to get into that one, Dan, but I totally agree. I think it's a question also, I mean, what Bill has done at Upton, where he's worked within the confines of a master plan that the foundation worked on, he does a sawtooth roof pattern to get 30 within 30% of north south orientation for every roof within the perimeter block.
Not so urban either.
Not at all. And so I think though it's an optimizing question, and it's a question that gets dealt with in the context, particularly if they're attached buildings, in terms of solar installations that supply a larger set of blocks. And it's a scale question, not necessarily a, you know, individual, solve it for each individual house question.
This is to segue into a shameless plug for four pages of this book. one of the things that I think we all lack is literacy about when different technologies kick in. So I think what you'll see tomorrow with Ed Mesria's presentation is a kind of complete ignorance on a lack of literacy on his part in terms of the contributions of urban forms of building energy efficiency.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
In the book, for example, we have a metric that basically says standalone house as a square, as an east-west, as a north-south. Attached to a row house in a long line, running east-west, running north-south. There are different configurations in watching how the energy improves as more walls and floors are shared and the impact of building orientation on that. That's a lookup chart in the book, and it's done for six climates. And then
very good.
For district energy, district heating and cooling, again, we have a chart, and we probably worked with the wrong people, but whatever, it's a chart of the thing that sort of says you need this much density proximate to a central plant to began to think that it's viable. Now, there are different systems. The book doesn't cover, but I know cover smaller scales. I was going to build, though, and respond to Andrew's comment about it's all about the money. One opportunity we have is a pilot program that we've been talking about is 120 projects or whatever number is finally decided will be admitted to the pilot, is to study the heck out of it and conclude at the end of the year that a typical, judging by the 120 in the pilot, the typical certified MD, has 11% less infrastructure, 20% less energy, 32% less VMT, whatever, certified silver, gold, and platinum, and there will be some average that we'll be able to say about each of those tranches of ratings, and that will be billboarded and on the cover of USA Today in about 9 to 12 months, and so that will be the metric that will travel with it for a while to come, so we're really excited about that.
We thank you all, and we have to...